This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Thank you.
So it was such a thrill to see this on the big screen. And one thing that really struck me was the emotional charge of the film, you know, all of these scenes. And my first question for you tonight is, what inspired you to make a film about this relationship between monuments and politics and history?
Right. I guess we have to go back in time a little bit, and exactly to 2012. Mm-hmm. This is the time when we started working on our first film. It's called The Folio Worth the Warrior. And in that film, we tell the story of a monument. But in this case, it's a monument that was built in Italy in 2012. To honor a fascist general, Rodolfo Graziani. And we happened to follow the story and also particularly the protest that the construction sparked and triggered, and especially among the Ethiopian community in the diaspora. This because Rodolfo Graziani, this fascist general, was known for his war crimes committed during the colonial enterprise in Ethiopia, and as well in Libya, but particularly in Ethiopia, where he was also viceroy of the colony for a while. That project lasted a few years, but it was the first time that where we saw this nature of monuments that really intrigued us, no? This capacity of monument to really ignite political action in present day. It was a way, perhaps, by not because the mayor that built this monument wanted initially, but it was also a way to recover a part of history, of Italian history, that is not discussed much. It was a way of talk about Italian colonialism or what happened. It's really a chapter of history that is not discussed much in school. Both Isaac and I studied there, and it was really a learning experience for us, really to learn about history, and doing so by following a political action in the present day. And so when we go back from that project, we finished it in 2015, we go back in the United States, but we always lived there. I moved here 12 years ago. But immediately we become interested with the symbol of Columbus. And so that's the film that we were going to make. It was a film about Christopher Columbus. We were really very, very curious to know more about this character and why it is. We wanted to know why, you know, it was so revered and celebrated by Italian Americans. That's something that we didn't experience growing up in Italy. Columbus is not a character that is so much monumentalized. There is a monument and statues in Genoa, the city where it's from, but it's not celebrated. And we don't have a national holiday like in Italy about Columbus. And at the same time, we were really also interested in the counterpart, right? And in the indigenous activists that have been protesting the symbol, the holiday, national holiday, they were telling us, no, another part of the story. And so that's the film that we wanted to make. And we researched a lot, some years. And then 2020 first started with COVID. You know? We all know we have to put the project in standby like many other filmmakers. And then at the end of May 2020, it was May 25th, if I'm not wrong, it's the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis that sparked the Black Lives Matter protest. And we started seeing the Columbus monuments going down, right? And then immediately we resumed the project. But at that point, we also understood that we have to go beyond Columbus. And this because it was the people on the street that were connecting those dots among those other symbols, no, of the national historical narrative. So the founding fathers statues went down and Confederates. And so in May 2020, we kind of scratched the project and we started this new one. We started by traveling. It really was, this film can really be seen as a road trip, as a diary, really, of those travels that we've done in the year and the year and a half. Mm-hmm. And then the idea was really to to capture this exceptional moment that was in front of our eyes, no? And like similarly, like we saw with the monument in Italy, the fascist monument in Italy, we saw really an opportunity, no? Through those protests to recover some chapters of history that are not discussed much. And it was really, we often say, no, an explosion of the past into the present. That's something that, I know, was it really, you know, struck us, and it was really kind of the focus of the film in the beginning, really trying to capture the moment, a moment really exceptional, without even thinking about too much of the form or who to interview or the structure of the film. It was really like, let's go in the streets. And we started in New York, where we live, but we soon made a trip to Philadelphia, you saw, and then even southern to Richmond. We knew about Trump going to South Dakota to make a speech in Mount Rushmore. Mm-hmm. So most of the time we had to also prevent and think ahead of what the next conflict was going to be, because it was really something that was moving so fast, right? Mm-hmm. And then at some point we realized that this project needed to grow and to go beyond the simple capture of the moment. I'm not sure, it was perhaps like in January, it was after the election of Biden, that we understood that we were going to make the same mistake that we didn't like. Now, the way media were portraying that movement, no? The spectacularization of the removals, no? It's the iconoclast fury, no? It was all over, no? The first page of journals and newspapers, but that's not what we saw. Even when we spoke with people in the streets, it was way more subtle and complicated, mm-hmm. and it wasn't just about removal. And that was clear from the beginning, no? Those activists were also rediscovering other place of memory, no? Perhaps place of memory that has not been discussed much, that a little underfunded mm-hmm. often. And also we start seeing, you know, the little seats being put on new monuments, perhaps. Now the idea of a new kind of memorialization that should come up, no? Even perhaps now that go beyond the classic statues on a pedestal, on a horse. Now we really saw an attempt by those communities on the ground to really rethink the way we memorialize history, you know, something that can perhaps be more inclusive, that perhaps, you know, interrogate and ask the community where you built that monument, not what they want, mm-hmm. because people need to have a saying of what we should put, no, in their square. So at the end, it was really, it became, no, something that try to go beyond the simple discussion. Oh, we want this monument. Yes, no, we don't want it. Like Columbus is good, not Columbus is bad. Wanted really to open up a broader reflection on the way we memorialize mm-hmm. history, and also the way the political activists can use this struggle to connect, you know, those past struggle to the present day. Because at the end, it was really, the movements, people on the street, no, show us they again and again and again were really like, they were for practical change in the present as much as they were about like retelling a more correct version of the past.
That's so interesting. So this film was born after first you had turned your lens onto monuments in Italy, and then it came back to turning the lens onto monuments here in the US. And I think the film really brilliantly intertwines the story of monuments with the story of movements. And we had the Black Lives Matter movement, we had Native American sovereignty, we have Italian American heritage. As you know, filmmakers with a kind of formazione italiana, from, you know, the outside looking in, what is it about the relationships between these monuments and these movements that you see as making them uniquely American?
Want to take that one?
Sure, I'll take a stab at it. it's an interesting question, and something that we had to sort of reflect, I think, in different ways at different times during the making of the film, because sort of the positionality of our gaze was certainly something that's very important to think about these days when you're making a documentary, and especially when you're making a documentary like this one that's, for the most part, not really telling the stories of communities that we belong to. And as you said, we have this sort of outside viewpoint for those who don't know. I also, while I sound American, I lived most of my life in Italy before moving to the States about 10 years ago. So I think going back to what Valerio said, I think the right at the beginning of the protest, we were really caught up in the energy of that moment, and you know, going out into the streets every day and talking to people and filming the protests that were happening. It was a really heated moment, obviously. And it was a moment in which, partially through what we saw was happening to monuments, but also in the broader protest movement, you could really feel beyond the specific demands that, of course, started with protests against police brutality and then systematic racism more broadly, but how it sort of grew quickly also into a wider anti-system protest, right? And there was this feeling of something revolutionary in the air. You could kind of see it in people's faces when you were talking to activists and filming these moments in the streets. As time went on, we had to start to think a little bit more about the form of the film, the structure of the film, and really what the deeper goal was going to be, I think, right? The message, this kind of stuff, and that broader story and the narrative, and how is it going to end, and all of these things. And that was tricky because we realized quite quickly we couldn't be the ones to provide sort of a definitive answer to some of these questions, or to come out with a complete sort of issue-driven film that would really get to the root, let's say, of Confederate monuments and why those are so problematic, or even the Columbus Monument, which is probably, you know, the symbol that we spend the most time with. Mm-hmm. There's so much history there, and there's so much context that we wouldn't probably be able to even grasp and convey because it doesn't even belong to us. So that's where we started to really, I think, be guided by the protesters themselves and the connections and the movements that we highlighted, like you mentioned, were the ones that were sort of coming out more often when we were following the news and what's the monument that's next that's going to be protested, that suddenly there's some news about or something like that. And that's where the road trip comes back in. It was always going to be a somewhat arbitrary film. It was always going to be somewhat limited, and we knew not an issue-driven film with talking heads that are going to give you all of this sort of like information and a specific message. I think what you see in the documentary is our own learning process in some way about those movements. And there was a lot of research, you know, behind the scenes. We read a lot of books. We had already read a ton before for our Columbus project. That was really our sort of the backbone of our research process. And then as we went into the months after the killing of George Floyd, and then into the next year, there was a lot more, you know, context that you see us learning it, I think, in the scene, and us drawing the connections between the different movements. Because, you know, it was obviously a period where intersectionality of movements was very much at the forefront. So in some ways, almost everything that we filmed is in the movie. Every scene, at least, is there. I know there's another question you wanted to ask later.
I wanted to ask about if there were any stories or
almost nothing.
Movements that ended on the cutting room floor. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, with the limited budget and a very small team, we were, you know, not able to film everything that we might have wanted, perhaps. But everything that we did in some way ended up making sense when we laid it out in the...
Which never happened. I mean, with the previous films, there were hours and hours of footage, entire interviews that didn't make the cut. So this time, I think everything kind of found its own place. This is really a mosaic kind of composition, and every little piece found its place. Besides, maybe perhaps we did follow a scene that didn't make it in the film, and is the scene in Waterbury where you see the beheaded Columbus. Well, we follow the head for a while as he was moving from house into storage and back again. So that we have the little kind of scene that didn't make it in the film, but the chapter about that statues that made the film. So that's what really, really matters.
I think in many of the scenes in Stonebreakers, the dramatic tension is rooted in this very polarized politics, you know, the Lakota protest, you know, and in Washington, D.C. Maybe could you speak more about how you approached these very polarized politics here in the U.S. as you were making the film?
No, that was something that we experienced throughout production, because, I mean, this is a film about the fights over monuments, but, I mean, in the backdrop of a very heated presidential election, and COVID and the pandemic as well. But the election, it's always there. I mean, we opened the film with Trump and that we almost ended with Biden, no? You see the 4th of July. So we wanted to, I mean, it was part of the story. It was also part of this film. And it was really polarized politically. And I think there are some scenes that exemplify that polarization, even the ending, you know, with Thanksgiving, like, and we saw how it's celebrated and remembered, let's say, differently. In the same square, they shared the same streets in Plymouth, and the monuments, you know, have a different meaning for these different crowds. And those are, I think it tells very well of what's even perhaps of what we are right now, no? With a very kind of polarized country. And then, yeah, those two groups of people that even if they share the same streets, they don't cross path. And that's where we are now, but eventually they will cross path. And we filmed some of that in 2020. That happened a lot. There were some moments of real conflict of where really kind of the, you know, but the history was discussed publicly in the streets. And we don't think it's negative per se. It's actually something that I think this is also a way we should approach history, you know? History should be discussed, even if the conversation can be a little, you know, violent, but what is important is we have this alive relationship, lively relationship, that we actualize history, that even if it makes us a little uncomfortable. And that's why we saw such an opportunity in that year and a half, you know? Really, it was really a way of looking at history more lightly, more in a way, in a more sober way, right? And perhaps, you know, looking at a more clear truth about what we are, what this country is, right? Now we are not in the same position. We know, you know, what happened. So there is so much work to be done still.
But I mean, I guess one of the reflections that we've arrived at, and I think we're continuing to learn more now as the film is being shown and we're having conversations like this, is kind of this. Of course, we have to acknowledge the you know, polarization, the huge distance that exists in this country, right, between these sort of two opposing ideas of what the country is, or at least what it should be. At the same time, it seemed to us that in those moments of contestation of the statue, the using of the symbol, right, to talk about these broader questions, there really was something new and some sort of opportunity there that perhaps we still have to seize. And yeah, it looked violent sometimes, and it's hard to hear, and you hear stuff bubbling up, right, in those moments that is really difficult to acknowledge and recognize that this is part of our society. You hear the racist comments, for example, in Philadelphia, that sort of thing. And then what was starting to come out was the counter-reaction, I guess, from certain elements, especially city administrations that would seek to take down the statues themselves, right, nominally satisfying the requests of the protesters. But sometimes in that process too, there was something of a missed opportunity, because oftentimes we would see the approach the city governments would take would be to disappear a monument overnight, right, with no public conflict, which is what they were seeking, right, to pacify the protest, to avoid the conflict, but also no confrontation, no moment of awakening of any sort. So if you just wake up one morning and the Columbus statue is just gone, I'm not sure that does much to advance what the material demands of the protesters were either, right? So it was really in the protest itself, in the dialogue, in the discussion, in the clashes that were happening, that maybe something could emerge when you bring it back indoors, right, from a public conflict like that into even settings like this and into the long conversation that I think we're still continuing to have about the meaning of history and present day politics and all of that. And instead, the reaction that we sometimes see of trying to pacify that, finding a historical symbol or monument that will have everyone agree, that will be conciliatory in some way, that probably doesn't exist, because there's too many different memories within a community, especially in a country like the States, where you brought up, there's, you know, so many, you know, different groups with different backgrounds, with different historical experiences. So it's really, I think, in the process that hopefully we see the opportunity to actually have productive conversations about this instead of seeking a definitive pacification that probably can't exist.
Yeah, because in having those conversations, there then has opens the possibility for healing, catharsis, as opposed to just disappearing a monument, right? Valeria, your comment about living history made me think more about this tension between, the tension between history and memory. And I was thinking of the work of Pierre Nora and Lieux de Mémoire, these places or realms of memory that Nora describes as any place or site or object or cause that's invested with meaning or historical significance from a community. And Nora was talking about history with a capital H as being that which has been written by the victors, right? And that has sort of overtaken and subsumed memory. But memory is more like this idea of living history, that it has its repository in the community, that it's a living and evolving thing. How do you see documentary film as balancing this tension or commenting on this tension between history and memory?
Great question. The place of memories, that's something that's something that we encounter throughout this film. I mentioned about this, that the idea that would be removed and they were being protested, but it was really the same people on the streets that pointing our attention. You should look at this other memorial that we just renovated, or we just rediscovered, or we are in the process of defending it, perhaps from a development, no? And then you see in the films, like the example probably is the Wounded Knee Memorial, no? In the Pine Ridge Reservation, or the African Burial Ground, or even the crosses, no? In that way, you can tell that, yes, this is a film perhaps more about memory and how memory works, no? And this things with memory that we have to keep it alive, no? Keep it flowing. It's really a collective effort. It's a collective machine that needs to be oiled here and there. And sometimes it's being oiled by activists, by the same conflicts that is needed. Perhaps with monument, what we saw is that monuments try to stop time. No, they mobilize it. They want it to freeze it. And then something that we should be very aware. No, it's really what really should change is our approach, not just to history, but just to monuments as well. No, to be very skeptic of them as a way of telling history. Actually, perhaps there is no worse way of telling history than a monument, because a monument, by definition, it's a statement of power, and presence in the public square, and it's somebody put it there to convey certain meanings, that he wanted to freeze in time and convey to future generation. So we should always be a little alert. If a monument is there, we should really ask ourselves, why it's there, who puts the monument? And that is kind of an exercise that we did perhaps with Columbus statues, and we go more into that aspect than the other monuments, because it's a story that we know more. And we have folklorist Joseph Shorra explaining it well, explaining why there are so many Columbus monuments and why they were put in the first place. That I think knowing that history and why would the story of the monument really tells a lot about even the present day, can really make a look at the Italian American community more clearly, and the politics of memory, that have been in the case of Italian Americans, that they have been applied. So Columbus was used really as a symbol, and it changed interpretation throughout history. It was first a symbol loved by Americans in 1776. And when they were looking for hero and to put in their pantheons, and then eventually in 1892, was something that was co-opted by Italian Americans seeking to, being actually approved and welcomed in this new country in a moment where there was discrimination to Italians. And then I think if we understand that and that transformation, we understand also what this monument deletes as well, because that's also something that we need to acknowledge. By putting a monument like that, you also erase other potential memories. In the case of Italian Americans, you're erasing the other stories that has to do with the union leaders, the labor activists, people that were coming from those working class masses, right? Perhaps when we understand this process and we get curious, now we can also even accept the idea that this symbol can change interpretation now. Now it's okay to problematize a symbol like that. And it's by doing that we can move forward.
So this just made me think that what was so interesting to me about the monuments showcased in this film was, again, the emotional charge surrounding them. Because when we think of monuments, usually we don't think of people having a violent conflict around them necessarily, right? Mm-hmm. They're kind of backdrop, but you're right, there's symbols that have been erected to showcase, you know, history with a capital H. And when we think about the distinction between monuments and memorials, and I'm thinking of the work of Erica Doss here, mm-hmm. memorials, a temporary memorial, say that's a roadside memorial to someone in a car accident, or flowers that are laid when right. someone has gone missing. These are memorials that are invested with emotion. And with the monuments, what came out was this bubbling of emotion around them that normally doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that this had to do with the politics of 2020. And so what do you think mm-hmm. this role of politics played in this kind of emotional bubbling up around monuments, and where did that the politics come into history and memory as you mm-hmm. were making the film?
Yeah. Big question. Yeah. I think one of the things that we noticed that was really interesting through filming, and hopefully you saw some of it in the documentary, is how those two things mix a lot, right? In those months, the memorial and the monument, and how the monuments, through the actions of protesters, are kind of transformed more into right. memorials, and we would say sometimes also counter monuments, another term that we've often seen used and have started to use ourselves to describe, you know, a symbol, an object that stands in opposition to the hegemonic monument, right? So the crosses mm-hmm. in the desert. But I think the most striking example of that is the Robert E. Lee mm-hmm. statue in Virginia, in Richmond, right? That from being this monument to that was essentially a monument of oppression, right, and of violence for, you know, a lot of citizens. Richmond is a majority black city who have to constantly drive by that object and see it and understand what it's what it means. So that's what it was. And going back to what you said too, that kind of statue, I think, for a lot of us, for people who have certain privileges in society, do become neutral or invisible in the landscape, right? It's possible for us to drive past a statue mm-hmm. like that and really not even wonder what it's about and who put it there, why it was put there. Obviously not the case for other people in our communities whose, you know, history is so directly connected and was so directly oppressed by the people who built that monument and who built it with the idea and the objective, right, of reinforcing those hierarchies. So you see this interesting mixing, and you see how when that monument, the pedestal, is completely covered by graffiti, right? And around it, we see all these small, you know, messages, informational messages, even in small tributes that are left by people, memorials. It completely changes the meaning of that space into something different. And then going back to what I said before, that thing is completely gone. We were in Richmond just a couple months ago for a screening of this film, and we went over there to that big roundabout on Monument Ave, and seeing even that part completely disappeared, and that space having been returned to a, you know, wealthy white neighborhood that excludes a lot of people who live in Richmond, was definitely, I think, a missed opportunity of some sort, mm-hmm. because it had become beyond the statue and the protests that took place there, even just a place of social aggregation mm-hmm. where you could have barbecues or you'd see kids playing every day mm-hmm. in the summer and stuff like that. So that's, you know, the mixing of the memorials and the monuments. I think it's telling us something about the politics of today. Going back to your original question, I guess politics is always part of our lives, probably mm-hmm. more than we think in every way. Something you mentioned earlier, actually, that is connected to this and I think is important, is we often think of the United States and the people of the United States as being a bit, having an ahistorical kind of perspective. Mm-hmm. I think in some ways that in Italy, a lot of Europeans, white, will make fun of America for this reason and sort of dismiss even activism and activist movements in the US for being sort of like very much lost in present day discourse and superficial questions of rhetoric as opposed to based in history. I think what we saw in those months was something of the opposite. It really was a moment in which I think we could realize that people were a little more aware of their history than we might have expected. Mm-hmm. And the core of that, I think what the protesters were asking us to do was to recognize historical continuity. That mm-hmm. is so important in a country like the United States. Again, Europeans will say, oh, they have no history, but the constitutional order of the United States and the legal institutions of the United States date back to the late 18th century. And that can't be said for almost any nation in Europe or in the world in most cases. That's why that's so important. That's why it's so important for black activists to point out a Confederate statue and say, "This we're attacking this not because it's a superficial symbol. It's not a symbolic battle for us. There's a direct specific continuity between the inequalities that we face today and the oppressions that we face today and those of our ancestors who were enslaved mm-hmm. by, you know, men like this." Mm-hmm. That's like the core of it is there, and perhaps it's not a history of notions, a deep understanding, but that's not necessary of that mm-hmm. specific historical character, what they did, what they didn't do. Oftentimes it was just anger at a broader system that, you know, any yeah. white man up on a pedestal mm-hmm. on a horse is going to represent that in some way, right?
If I may add, no, it was really about reappropriation, no, mm-hmm. of the public space. Yeah. And sometimes we kind of forget about that, but that what the example really tells us, no, is this: people were not just attacking and vandalizing mm-hmm. this Confederate monument; they were really reappropriating a neighborhood, from where they were excluded. And that symbol from exclusive became an inclusion. No, it was really a gathering place for the protest. People were was a moment, no, a place where people were mobilized mm-hmm. to go on protest. So just even to meet and to have meetings. I think that's, you know, if we take for granted what Isaac said, everything is political. Mm-hmm. No, then we should assume, as a collectivity, no, the responsibility of what goes mm-hmm. in our square, no, what monuments go and what we should put there. We shouldn't leave that to some mayor or how you call it, city mm-hmm. planners or urban keepers. No, mm-hmm. like it's falls on us, mm-hmm. no, and that's why I think it's important to see how community now are working and really redefining what a monument should be. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the crosses, no. Mm-hmm. Those are collective efforts. They're like, it's a group, various group or nonprofits, no, mm-hmm. that come together, you know, and they start from the ground up, really mm-hmm. reimagining and putting those crosses, or the prototypes as well, no, that we filmed in Philadelphia. The new monuments that just came out in New York City about, and I invite you to go and visit, if you happen to visit New York, to the Triangle Fire, close to Greenwich Village. This is a memorial that took many years, but mm-hmm. it was really much of a collective effort mm-hmm. by unions, by historians and professors mm-hmm. like you, by students, and they put up this very beautiful memorial to a collective of yeah. people that were, in this case, the victims of this tragic fire that happened at the beginning mm-hmm. of the 900, where many workers died. Mm-hmm. So we have good example of yeah. what we can do.
You just telegraphed my next question about if there was a monument that got it right. And it sounds like it was exactly
this one.
This,
I yeah. invite you to check it out. Mm-hmm. We actually made a little bit of advertisement here, but we did a little short documentary for Casa Italiana NYU, mm-hmm. that is among also the sponsor of this film. And we made a short documentary about that whole experience. So we used some of their archival material, some footage to show how this monument was thought, imagined, and then built by a collective of people, and eventually to honor a collective of workers that died there. So you can find it online.
Great, thank you. So I have one last question before we open up the questions to the audience. It's just on a personal note, given everything you were filming, the emotional charge of it all, sometimes the violence mm-hmm. that you were running up against. What was it like for you to be in the middle of all of that conflict personally while making the film?
It's always a changing experience. Everything we do, no? It's a learning experience for us. It's a defining experience. It takes all ourselves, and we come out eventually as change, improved people. And this is because of all the amazing people that we met, you know, during this film. This is really, this whole film wouldn't be possible without many conversations that we have on and off cameras, you know, with the many activists that we met during those trips. So we are personally invested, you know, from the beginning to the end in a project like this, you know. Knowing also that we don't have an answer, and you saw in this film, perhaps we leave you with more questions, but I mean, that's the whole point. We hope, no, not, we don't want, you didn't want to make an exclusive, a definitive film about this. So we know also that we, that our telling of the story is partial, no? And we are not the only films, no? There are many other filmmakers that made incredible works about this, and I invite you to see it, no? If you're looking at the story, specific story about the Lakota Nation and Mount Rushmore, there is a great documentary about that, or about Confederates monuments. So hopefully we can be part of that conversation.
I think one of the lessons we've learned from this film is the importance of conversation and keeping the conversation going around monuments, around politics, around movements. And I'd like to thank you for having this conversation with us here tonight at UCSB, and thank all of you for coming. Please join me in thanking Valerio and Isaac of Awan Films.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Stephanie, for having us.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.